built towns and businesses. They stayed and made a new world here on the far side of the Western frontier, one characterized by an equality of opportunity unknown anywhere else. McWilliams first acknowledged the brutality that these first well-educated and highly motivated Californians inflicted as they solved the Indian problem, the water problem, and the constant need to import cheap migrant labor to create modern agribusiness. Yet the gold rush and its democratic principles attracted people from every state in the Union and from all around the globe, an exceptional circumstance, mixing the multitudes, making Californians diverse before diversity was even devised, more like America than America itself, as Kerry McWilliams put it. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. In the past several months, we've done programs about ecosystems you might not have thought much about. We've explored the ecosystems of the ant, the electron, the tundra, caribou, and today we're going to explore the ecosystem of the chili pepper. So we're listening to a little bit of Red Hot Chili Peppers music, Tip of My Tongue. Our guests will be Dr. Stephanie Walker. She's a chili pepper expert at New Mexico State University. And then later we'll talk with KZFR's own Senior Felipe, Phil Elkins, who for two-plus decades ran a salsa business here in Chico. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced, organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. And I'll bet they've got some chili peppers in those recipes. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, they're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, are at 530-399-0675. And they're on Facebook and Instagram. And we're also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and the North State Symphony, performing an upbeat, light-hearted concert entitled Haydn's Drum Roll. This will be February 11th in Chico, February 12th in Redding. Showcasing the youth talent in our North State, this concert features the season's young adult audition winners as well as area youth orchestras. Selections from Schubert, Telemann, Offenbach, and more will be featured. More information at tickets at northstatesymphony.org. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Right now we're going to bring you our interview. This was pre-recorded yesterday from New Mexico, Las Cruces, New Mexico. It's with Dr. Stephanie Walker of New Mexico State University. She's on the staff of the Chili Pepper Institute. Tonight we're exploring the ecosystem of the chili pepper. Chili peppers come in many varieties and colors. You can eat them straight, you can sear them, braise them, bake them, dip them in batter and deep fry them, stuff them, use them as seasoning, and of course you can burn your mouth or your skin with them. So with us via Zoom from Las Cruces, New Mexico, is Dr. Stephanie Walker. She's of the New Mexico State University and their Chili Pepper Institute. Welcome, Stephanie Walker.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Tell us a little bit. We don't know a lot about your background. Please tell us about that background, and then we'll hear a little bit more about chili peppers and the Institute.
And how you got engaged in chili peppers. That's what I want to know.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. It's convoluted story a bit. I actually got my undergraduate degree from New Mexico State University in biology. After I graduated, I got a job at Mountain Pass Canning, which is the old El Paso processing facility. Okay. So at the time, it was the largest green chili jalapeno processor in the world. And I worked there about 10 years and really developed a deep love for all these tons and tons of fresh peppers that we were getting in and processing. So that was about the time I really wanted to go back to graduate school to study breeding. Mainly, you know, I could see all these chili peppers coming into our production lines, and there were issues with them. I thought, you know, through breeding, we could fix these problems and make for a better processed pepper. So I was fortunate to be admitted into Dr. Paul Boslin's chili breeding program. I got my master's with him. Then I took the job as extension vegetable specialist, and I continued my research with paprika breeding, got my PhD. And so that's really why I kind of went via industry and then back into academia. And I've basically been working with chili peppers my whole adult life for a very long time.
So was there a Chili Pepper Institute when you went back for your PhD, or has that begun as a result of kind of your specialty and the work that you've been doing, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so I joined Dr. Paul Boslin's program as a graduate student in 1995, and the Chili Pepper Institute was first initiated in 1992. So okay. I missed it by about 2 or 3 years. At the time, it was in a little closet in the room where all the graduate student desks were. So I definitely saw it at its very beginning. You know, from there, the fame and popularity of the Chili Pepper Institute grew, and they gave us more space. We took on a lot more projects, and now it's actually is in a very large office space in Gerald Thomas Hall, one of our main agricultural buildings at New Mexico State University.
So what's the purpose of the Chili Pepper Institute? What are they, what's their mission? What are they trying to accomplish? And what are some of the projects?
Okay, absolutely. Well, the Chili Pepper Institute is the only international nonprofit organization dedicated to the research and information spreading of chili peppers. So we're a nonprofit, and basically we want to get all the latest research, all the latest information, and distribute this to other academic researchers, the general public, industry, all chili pepper lovers around the world. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of things. We actually have a store, an online store. So mm-hmm. we sell funds. So if you buy seed packets or other chili-related paraphernalia from the Chili Pepper Institute, it goes directly into our salaries and maintaining our programs. Every year, we do support the New Mexico Chili Conference. So this is an annual conference. It's always held the first Tuesday of February, where we present...
Coming right up.
It sure is. Yeah, so we're hustling. We're in conference mode right now.
Yeah.
So we get certainly researchers from New Mexico State University, but we always have at least one that's invited in to talk about the latest, you know, cutting edge research information and initiatives for chili peppers. And it's held at the Las Cruces Convention Center. So we have a reception
tonight,
and then Tuesday is the all day conference. Another big thing that the Chili Pepper Institute supports is an annual chili pepper teaching garden. So this is actually at an ag science center that's adjacent or about a block away from campus. And every year we plant small plots of you know, hundreds of different chili pepper varieties from around the world. So we always have school classes, local community groups, visitors from out of state. A lot of international visitors come just to see the great diversity in fruit shape, size, color. And you can actually get in the field and really see these interesting varieties firsthand.
So this is a really maybe naive question, but what's the purpose of having more and more and more varieties of chili peppers?
Well, you know, so I dabble in breeding as part of my research. And right. One thing you'll find being a plant breeder is you never, ever come up with the perfect variety. There's always something new, some new characteristic that a group of people or an industry are going to want. So with chili peppers, you know, one of the real straightforward one is the heat level. So amongst humans, right. Large difference in what type of heat level they like. You know, we're always trying to push yield. So yield, of course, is critical for whether you're a grower, or commercial grower, right. Or home gardener. So we always want to increase either the fresh yield or the dry yield. In some cases, we're improving chili pepper varieties for specific purposes, like pigment content. You know, actually, there's a product, oleoresin paprika, that's a natural red food coloring that's derived from very low pungency paprika. And if you can push that that content of those pigments up, that makes it more valuable for the grower as well as the industry. And a couple years ago, I actually released a New Mexico green type that works better for mechanical harvest. So it's just something as simple as the plant architecture, the amount of force it takes to take those green fruit off the plant makes it much better for mechanical harvest as opposed to older varieties that a lot of the fruit stay on the plant. So yeah, there's always something, you know, there's always something. And I'm not even mentioning another real obvious one, disease and pest resistance.
Oh, of course, you know, yeah.
Diseases, pests are going to continue to evolve and get better at what they do. And so the breeders need to work on getting chili peppers that can withstand these pressures better.
How many rows or acres do you have to plant before you've had enough to say, yes, this is the one we want, it's not a fluke?
Yeah, you know, it takes probably minimum about 10 years to develop a new variety. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first of all, you're looking at usually segregating populations. So the bigger of a population, the more selections you can take, the better. And then once we work on inbreeding the new lines with the desired characteristics, it takes at least three different locations or three different years in replicated trials with varieties they're very similar to prove that you have something that's better than the existing varieties. So it's a very long-term process.
So, okay, you go.
I wanted to ask about genetic engineering. Is there any push to genetically engineer a better chili pepper?
No, you know, a lot of crops have developed GMOs and they're commonly used. There are no GMO chili peppers. We did discover, you know, years ago, they did dabble in this a bit and they discovered chili peppers were a crop that are very difficult to transform. And we've also had a lot of pressure from consumers that they just don't want it. Right. So we don't. So right here, anyone who says, oh, peppers are all GMO, there are no GMO peppers. Period. So all the work that we've done is traditional breeding.
Let's jump back in history a little bit. How old are the chili peppers? I know they've been cultivated forever and ever. Tell us about that history, please.
Yeah, so chili peppers are believed to have been around, you know, more than 10,000 years. That humans have actually discovered them and gathered them in the wild. So chili peppers actually had their origin in down in South America and Middle America. We believe they originated from about the border of Bolivia and Brazil. And, you know, early on, we know humans about 7,000 years ago would gather them from the wild. And, you know, originally they were used for their medicinal purposes. You know, I think we all know about the endorphin effect you get if you eat chili peppers. Your body is in pain. And so we release natural brain compounds that make us feel good, the endorphins. So that, and also the numbing effect you get from using chili peppers. So the Mayans, the Aztecs would use it for various pains, toothaches, other pains in their body. Chili peppers were one of the earliest crops, though, that underwent domestication. So, you know, after humans had been collecting chili peppers from the wild, they started actively selecting chili peppers for larger fruit, different heat levels, different color, size. And so, yeah, chili peppers have been undergoing breeding, traditional breeding by humans for thousands and thousands of years.
So are chili peppers still used medicinally? And if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I know there's a fairly well-known arthritis cream, capsaicin with a Z. so that contains capsaicin, the chemicals that make chili hot. So that's one of the obvious ones. And there's other hot icy creams and such that are used.
Right. I remembered my question earlier, and then I forgot it again. But it was about how... you know, you have all of these cultivars, all of these varieties. Do you sell them around the world or around the U.S. or, and help people say, okay, this is appropriate for your climate, for your, kind of soil, so forth?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Chili Pepper Institute can certainly provide that information. I will say that, you know, New Mexico is the hot spot for chili in the United States. But there's other parts of the world, other countries that are also their own hot spots. And actually, the United States, we are not the greatest producer of chili peppers. New Mexico has the greatest chili pepper production in the United States. But India, China, the Philippines, many other countries, Mexico obviously is another one that produce more chili peppers than us. So other countries may be interested in our types, but many of these countries have their own type of chili pepper that their local populations really love. And so, you know, introducing a new type of chili pepper, it might be novel for them, but it's not necessarily something they seek out because they have their chili peppers that they love. Mm-hmm. Just like here in New Mexico, we love our chili peppers.
So do people come to your conference from other places other than New Mexico? So is it, I'm thinking of California grows quite a lot of peppers. So do you have participants from other good pepper growing regions?
Oh, yes, yes. We always get some from other states or other countries even. And we all at New Mexico State University, we have very active research collaborations with researchers from California, from Texas, New York, up at Cornell. So yeah, we definitely strengthen collaboration.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Dr. Stephanie Walker. She's of the New Mexico State University Chili Pepper Institute. And I have to say, I was surprised when we wanted to do this program. I just Googled around, and lo and behold, the Institute popped up. I didn't realize there was such a thing. Could we go back a little bit to the spread? So they started out in South America. How did they spread globally?
Yeah, so the wild chili peppers were very, very small fruited, berry type fruit. And we still actually see some of these growing in the wild. They're known as chiltepines. Mm. So back then, they're the perfect food for birds. So it's this great symbiotic relationship where you'd have these chiltepines with these very small red fruit. The fruit would be upright. And once they turn red ripe, they're very easily detached from the plant. So birds see these red fruit. Birds cannot actually taste the pungency, so they're not put off by the heat. They would eat these berries, they'd fly off, and then when they do their business, they deposit their seed along with some fertilizer. So initially, birds spread the seed around South and Middle America. And after humans, though, started dabbling in this and started domesticating them, humans started to trade seed and chili peppers, you know, up and down the trading route. As far as the United States, we do know that in New Mexico, chili peppers were introduced more than 400 years ago. And we believe this was actually by Spanish explorers. So we know that the first written records by the old world of discovering chili peppers was by Christopher Columbus.
Oh, no.
Yeah, many people have heard the old story about Christopher Columbus was looking for black pepper. He was looking for the Indies. Instead, he found the New World, and he found red chili peppers. And, you know, he was also quite the marketer, so he quickly said, hey, these red chili peppers are much better than the black ones. So he did take seed back to the old world, and but there they quickly spread by various trading routes. You know, reached Asia, reached around the world, and in many countries like the Asian countries, Spain, some African countries. I mean, they quickly embraced chili peppers, and that's where they developed their own, you know, preferred varieties, preferred flavor, preferred pod type. So this is something, you know, Christopher Columbus certainly did some questionable things, but he did introduce chili peppers to the old world.
I was going to mention, I think Wikipedia calls it the Columbian Exchange. And I wondered what the Native Americans got in exchange for Christopher taking back the chili pepper. Maybe not very much.
Yes.
She's gone blank again.
I'm really having trouble with my brain today. I wanted to know how many forms chili peppers actually end up in. We know about salsa and hot sauce, and there are a million varieties now of hot sauce and pepper flakes. What are the kind of varieties of ways that chili peppers are used and produced?
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Oh, boy, good. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Well, so you know, here in New Mexico, you know, we have a wide variety of foods that we put chili peppers in. In fact, everything. You know, my daughter, when she moved away from New Mexico to go to graduate school a few years ago, was surprised to actually see on the menus that everything did not have chili peppers in it. Yeah. So you know, here we really it's said, it's very true that many New Mexicans, you know, have chili peppers with every meal in one form or another. You know, everything from spicy ketchup to putting, you know, green chili in our scrambled eggs, jalapenos on our pizza, you know, green chili stew. Chili rellenos are really the classic, where it really is a New Mexico type chili pepper. It's long green chili pepper that's peeled, stuffed with cheese and fried.
My favorite. I love chili relleno. I love it.
Yes, they're very good. And that's why, you know, once again, you don't want to get one that's too hot, or you know, you quickly overwhelm yourself.
Or too mild. If they're too mild, they're, you know, it's just flat. My brother and I, we're from Arizona, and we went on a mission one time to try to find the best chili relleno. And they're prepared in so many different ways. You know, some of them like fluffy batter on them, and some of them almost like an omelet. And we never decided which was the best one we found, but we liked eating all of them.
Yes.
Please tell us a little more about the chemistry. And
I'm sorry. The varieties, varieties that they're produced, like pepper flakes and pepper. Pepper.
So I guess the big one that may surprise people is here in New Mexico, our paprika. So we refer to paprika as New Mexico type chili that's very low in pungency, very highly pigmented. So chili peppers have two very, very unique red pigments that are rarely seen in nature, you know, very, very rare in nature. So capsanthin is a dark brownish red pigment. I'm sorry, capsarubin is a dark brownish red pigment. Capsanthin is a bright brick red pigment. And these are two very stable red pigments that many years ago, when we were having trouble with artificial red dyes, it was discovered we can use these pigments from red chili. Mm. So we actually have a company, there's a couple plants here in the United States that actually extract the red color than paprika chili. And then this red coloring is used in a wide variety of foods. So if you ever see natural red food coloring on an ingredient list, very likely it's New Mexico paprika that's coloring that mayonnaise, those pepperonis, you know, virtually any processed food that has a reddish tinge to it, that's added, likely came from chili peppers.
Interesting.
I was starting to ask about the chemistry and why they burn and where that's located in the chili pepper. Tell us a little bit. How do you pronounce the name of that, of the chemical? Capsicum?
Capsaicin.
Capsaicin.
Yeah. Capsaicin.
Okay.
Yeah. So capsaicin and five other closely related capsaicin compounds create the heat. And they actually bind to the same receptors in your mouth that cause pain from heat, from thermal heat. So that's why instead of saying pungency, we often say it's the heat of the chili peppers, because it very is the same receptors that are firing in your mouth when you eat peppers containing capsaicin. So capsaicins are unique that only members of the capsicum genus produce it. So you don't see that. You see other things like, you know, ginger, like cinnamon. They have some burn to them, but capsaicin is unique for chili peppers.
And how do they literally burn your skin? I'm thinking, I was looking at a recipe for ghost peppers and they said, wear gloves.
Yeah. It's the same receptors as heat.
Okay.
So the same way you'd burn yourself with a stove or a candle, you can burn yourself with very high capsaicin content.
Mm-hmm.
So is climate change affecting pepper production? Is part of your work to figure out how to make peppers more resilient?
Yes, absolutely. You know, climate change is going to affect all segments of agriculture. So certainly, you know, here in New Mexico, it has created drier conditions. So we get less irrigation water. We get less river flow when the farmers actually need it coming from the north. So most of the growers, actually all of the growers who continue to grow chili peppers need some kind of supplemental water to surface water. So there's much well pumping. Because water allotments have dropped, you know, many chili growers have had to keep some of their fields fallow as they don't plant all the fields that they could potentially plant if they had enough water. So that's somewhat restricted the number of acres that growers can grow. Another issue we do have is erratic climate conditions. You know, there's evidence that we're getting more hail events. If you get a hail event at the wrong time, you could just like obliterate a chili field. Late frosts or early frosts, you know, both can nip you either at the beginning or end of the season. And we're seeing a lot more weird weather events like that. Rainfall, you know, we just saw about all the horrible flooding and rain damage in California. We know that the experts say that with climate change, with the warming environment, you know, clouds can hold more water and that lets it all loose in torrential floods. We have diseases here in New Mexico like chili wilt. If we have flooded field conditions, it can kill a whole chili field really, really quickly. So these really erratic wild weather patterns can really hurt chili production.
Is the growing season changing, or has that happened yet?
Well, it does seem like it does seem like we can start earlier, but if we get that frost, you know, it throws, because chili peppers are very frost tolerant, so that will kill everything. So it's almost like it's so nice and warm here weeks before you'd usually want to start. But if you get a killing frost, you're going to have to go in and replant, unfortunately.
So do farmers come to you and say, help, we're having this problem. Is there a pepper that's better for us? Or is there something that we can do that would help our production?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So in addition to being the co-director of the Chili Pepper Institute, I'm also the extension vegetable specialist.
Okay.
I'm here to answer and help all growers from home gardeners to the largest farm operations we have in New Mexico.
And are you out in the field, or is that always, are they always coming to you?
No, it goes both ways. It's
nice.
On the field, yeah, quite a bit. I have my own research plots at various experiment stations. So we're doing that as well as visiting with growers.
And so what's your research interest? What are you mostly working on? What's your passion when it comes to the world of figuring out chili peppers?
Yeah, well, definitely figuring out how to cope with the challenges of climate change, as we just discussed, is one. But, you know, my long-term research has been in developing new chili pepper varieties. As I told you, I joined the chili breeding program when I came back to graduate school. My first work was really working the paprikas to increase the pigment content. So, you know, many years ago, we did release New Mex Garnet, which is an open pollinated, highly pigmented paprika. And then 2 years ago, I released New Mex Odyssey, which is a New Mexico green type that performs better for mechanical harvest. You get a better harvest if you're using a machine, because certainly labor shortages, labor issues have been a real challenge for New Mexico chili growers, as well as anybody who's growing any real labor intensive fruit and vegetable in the United States.
So are you working on something right now? Is that a secret?
No, actually, I guess my current challenge is we're going to experiment with agrivoltaics. We already know there's preliminary evidence to show that chili peppers can perform even better, quite well under partial shading. Mm. And so we feel by putting solar panels and partially shading our chili plots, okay, we can both generate electricity potentially for the growers, you know, get double use out of farmland, and then also maybe get more productive chili peppers. So right now we're scrambling trying to get the infrastructure installed before the growing season rapidly approaching.
Wow, that's great.
That's really exciting. We read about or heard about that a couple of weeks ago, that yes, shielding crops with the solar panels increases the yield, keeps them from burning up, and provides juice.
Yeah, it may also protect from hail too. I mentioned more hailstorms. So, certainly, you know, here during the summers, it can just get oppressively hot. We have just huge intense light that I know with our tomatoes, you'll actually get fruit disorders just because of the intense sunlight we get. And, you know, we always have issues like blossom end rot on chili peppers. So partial shading with solar panels through agrivoltaics may help with the blossom end rot levels as well.
Hmm. Right. I know you have some kids programs at the Institute. Tell us what happens. What do kids see when they come to the museum?
Yeah, so it's actually, I wouldn't quite call it a museum yet. We're working on that. Mm-hmm. That's actually another big initiative, along with the agrivoltaics, is where we're working with the industry and with other partners to develop a standalone Chili Pepper Institute. So, you know, right now we're housed in an ag building. And so it's a bit, we get a lot of visitors there, but it's a bit hard to find. And so the second floor of our Gerald Thomas Ag building. Yeah. So kids will come through. Mainly what we do is we'll do programs for kids, and especially out there, the teaching garden that I mentioned earlier. Yes. So groups will come, you know, on their buses, and we talk about the history of chili. We talk about the different types of chili, and out there in the field, we can actually show them instances of different varieties that are grown around the world. We also go into classrooms often. Chili Pepper Institute personnel are really in demand to give talks to various groups, from school kids to retiree groups.
Are any kids doing their high school science project on chili peppers?
We have definitely had quite a few over the years.
All right. That's great. Yeah.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guest has been Dr. Stephanie Walker of the Chili Pepper Institute at New Mexico State University. You can learn more about the Institute and chili peppers at cpi.nmsu.edu.
So, did I get that right?
I think I got it right.
Okay.
Yeah.
cpi.nmsu.edu. So, thank you so much. This is really, I just had no idea that this kind of work was going on with chili peppers. It's very cool. Thank you so much for taking time.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Very welcome.
So, chili peppers. As you could hear in that interview with Stephanie Walker, even the ecosystem of the chili pepper is powerfully affected by global warming. The farmers are concerned about the growing season, warm weather, cold weather, the water supply. They're drilling wells deeper. These are all concerns that we're familiar with in California. And again, despite the heavy rainfall here in the North State over the past several weeks, the weather people remind us regularly that the drought is not over, that rainfall remains unpredictable. And there's a broader concern about whether or not agriculture on the current irrigated level is even sustainable. These are all issues that we will continue to explore on Ecotopia. Now, here's our second interview tonight. It explores the ecosystem of the chili pepper from another angle, that of salsa. Here is our interview with KZFR programmer Phil Elkins. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and today we are exploring the ecosystem of the chili pepper. Our guest via a pre-recorded Zoom is Phil Elkins, and everybody out here knows him for several decades as Senior Felipe, host of LA Sounds. It airs Wednesdays 3 to 5 here on KZFR. Used to be on Saturday, and he's shipped, but he's probably one of the most long-running programmers at KZFR, and we all love LA Sounds. Phil was also a salsa maker for a number of years here in Chico, and he has a chili pepper as part of his Senior Felipe logo. And if you contribute to KZFR, you can get sweatshirts. You can get all kinds of swag with the chili pepper on it. So, Phil, let's start. How did you get into the salsa business here in Chico?
I grew up in East L.A. Everybody but me was Latino. And so I would go to their houses, and you know, they wanted me to eat menudo, and I didn't care for that much. My best friend's mother made homemade tortillas. She put butter on them and salsa. I said, hey, what's this? She said, that's my homemade salsa. So I was, you know, a teenager, and I would go over there and eat all the time. And then when I wound up in Chico, I was a manager at Chico Natural Foods. Mm-hmm. And I think they had like lavatoria or something terrible like that. And I said, oh my God, I can make something better than that. So I started making salsa, and it just sold like crazy. And pretty soon all the other stores wanted it, and all the other health food stores wanted it. I had a farmer that grew everything organically. And then I got distributors, and they took it pretty much everywhere, every natural food store from Hawaii to New York City.
I got some more questions here. Like the first batch you made, how was this in a pot on your kitchen stove, or how big was it?
Yeah, it was fresh, so I didn't cook it.
That's right, of
probably,
course.
I probably made it in a bucket, you know, a gallon bucket, maybe something like that, mm-hmm. and put it into little glass containers, you know, like ball glass containers. And then I thought, okay, I better get like cottage cheese containers, plastic cottage cheese containers. Mm-hmm. And then I had the logo printed up and what they call the romance, you know, the story, the history. I think what it said was you could take the guy out of East L.A., but you can't take East L.A. out of the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and so.
But your heritage, though, is Ukrainian Jewish. You're not exactly a Tex-Mex guy.
No, I'm not. And by the time I came up, I was a minority. Everybody, all my friends, girlfriends, everything were Latino. And so, you know, I tried to pass and talking and dressing and everything else like I fit in. And the best way to do that was to be a cholo. But it was, you know, interesting because the few Jews around didn't accept me. And a lot of Hispanics looked down on cholos. So it was a confusing situation. But they liked my food.
Yeah. So I want to know how you got from little ball glass jars to cottage cheese plastic things to how long did that take, and how did you start? You know, how did you say, okay?
I thought, okay, I need a logo. I need, you know, some artwork. And this guy who used to do like a newspaper for Chico News and Review, he would do the covers. And his name was Mike Thomas. And he got a hold of me and said, I could put together something for you. And I said, okay. I told him what size and what I wanted and what I wanted it to say. And he did a few different designs. And I said, I like that one. And and I used some East LA slang. Orale, pues. Orale, pues. That's East LA slang for, hey, boy. What this is, anyway, orale, pues. This also is the best. And the design. And then he did a cartoon figure of me, you know, cartoon figure of me in East LA. And I thought, okay, that works. But then I thought, okay, I better start putting it in jars and canning it so it could go across the country. Because you could ship it locally. It went fresh all the way to Arcata Natural Foods. Okay. But if you wanted to go to, you know, across the country, it's got to be in sealed jars. So I got a bunch of equipment, you know, I had to have put together. And I would do 600 pints at a time. Canned 600 pints at a time.
And that's where my ignorance came about the making of it. Did you have to sterilize it, heat it up before you put it in the jars?
No. I got this big vat that was, you know, a couple hundred gallons. Mm-hmm. And I'd put it in the jars. And I had these big old lifter. I had a crane and everything that would put it in the water and boil the water.
Okay. Okay.
For, you know, 45 minutes or whatever. And I pull it out and they cool it down. And then the health department wanted me to have a code on it and I had to put labels on it. And then every batch I made, the health department wanted to approve. So I had to pay the health department to come around, you know, all the time, every time I made a batch. and then what they told me was, I get the same kind of inspection Campbell's Soup gets. So, you know, between that and the insurance and the price of tomatoes and the price of jars and labels, everything, you know, pretty soon it's like, this is getting to be an expensive proposition. So, but I kept doing it and I had people working for me. And then, lo and behold, other people started copying me. Everything from Senor Felix, you know, and my designs. And they tried to copy the recipe. Nobody could do that, though. And then, lo and behold, Paul Newman comes around. Well, he got the name. He's got the money.
Yeah.
It's all for charity. And at first, every distributor across the country came to me. But once Paul Newman came around, you know, between, like I said, the insurance and the health department,
right,
and competition, people owed me money, thousands of dollars. And, of course, they weren't anxious to pay me ahead of time. And they'd go bankrupt. And then I lost money. That money was gone.
So how long were you in the business and how long was it had the market?
Uh-huh. I started in 1980, just about the same time Sierra Nevada started the brew pub.
Okay, yeah.
And sometimes I would talk to the owner about, you know, suggesting he came check my place out and you know, he was very helpful. But I think I did it for about 25 years. Wow. And then I would get phone calls all hours of the night and the day. And, hey, we need 400 cases of hot enchilada sauce by Tuesday, which meant I have to work 24 hours a day and deliver it, you know.
Right.
And I would deliver it to different distributors, or they'd come to my place. But then I got, like, a factory, and I had to get employees and a forklift. And pretty soon, it was that's all I had time for. Meanwhile, I was going through a divorce, and I had my kids half time, and my mom died, my dad died, and pretty soon I'm thinking, why am I doing this? You know, and I just let it go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Was that your sole source of income? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was working part-time at Chico High School.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that...
And you know, I had commercials out there on the television, and it was fun, it was exciting, but I needed money. I probably needed at least $100,000 for good equipment. And so I went to a bank and borrowed money at 10% interest, and started mortgaging my house. And pretty soon I realized, this is exhausting. I had people that wanted a job. That don't mean they wanted to work, you know. And so one day, you know, I just stopped answering the phone, and I stopped doing it. Yeah. The health department, insurance, and the price of tomatoes would go anywhere from $3 a box to $30 a box. And pretty soon people weren't paying me. You know, the local stores, they did good. But, you know, if you I'd ship it to a natural food store, say, in the Midwest, you know, and they would take 90 days to pay me.
So did you just... Did you just have one recipe? Were you just making one salsa?
I started with mild, then I went to hot, very hot, killer hot, and enchilada sauce, tropical, barbecue sauce, pasta sauce. I was doing all these different sauces. And I even started doing garbanzo, you know, and everything.
But oh, my gosh.
I needed money. I needed money, and the only way I could get it was start mortgaging my house.
And
I did, but you know, I had what they call a floater loan. Go anywhere in 15-20%, and pretty soon I realized I couldn't. I stopped doing it.
So was there a time when you made a lot of money and you thought, "Wow, I'm on top of the world," or was it always kind of pushing around the edges?
I started making, real good money, you know. One year I made $50,000. I thought, okay, next year it's going to be twice as much, and it's going to keep going, and keep growing. Pretty soon you're dealing with, okay, the city, the county, the state, and they all, you know, got all their regulations. And you got to buy these licenses and insurance. And pretty soon, I got a BA in sociology. I'm a social worker. What do I know about running a business?
Our theme for the show is the chili peppers. So tell us, you alluded to that, you had organic. How many different peppers did you use in the different sauce? Tell us how the chili pepper entered in.
I started with jalapenos, you know.
Okay.
And those got a good flavor, and they're not too hot. But then people want hot. Okay, so what? I started getting, Thai pepper. Because I had one of my best friends was Thai, and he grew Thai peppers. And that you got to be careful. You can get burned. I mean, you touch it with your hand, and if your hands touch the wrong place on your face or other places, it's like, whoa, you know. So I after a while, people like hot, very hot, killer hot. But, there are some people that don't want it hot. So you have mild.
Right.
So you got to be careful, because mild, could be hot. You're not careful. I had this big old mixer, chopper that could do, probably 30 gallons at a time. Tomatoes, peppers, onions, everything in there. Boom! And then I was going to keep doing it, but, the health department, it seemed like they really weren't helpful. They weren't being very helpful.
Right.
It seemed like they wanted to stop me. I don't know why. Jealousy or what?
Yeah.
But then, the competition came in and they had money. They had the equipment.
Right. Did you have a favorite kind of salsa yourself? I mean, of all of the things all of the salsas you made, did you have a favorite?
Yeah, I like tropical.
Tropical. Does that have fruit in it? Or... what was that?
Oh, yeah. Pineapple.
Okay, yeah.
Pineapple, jicama,
Yeah.
That's my favorite. I like it's kind of sweet, you know. And then with that, you do various, you know, mild, hot, very hot, killer hot, you know. But yeah, that was my favorite. And I like the enchilada sauce too.
Did you invent all of the recipes, or did you have sources from your friends' mothers or anything like that from your old days?
I started off with my best friend in East LA.
Right.
His mother, she made it. And I kind of watched. He didn't give me the recipe. I kind of watched. And then I started experimenting. I thought, well, hell, you know, I experiment with different spices. Like, you got to be careful. If you put in too much cumin, it becomes enchilada sauce.
See, right,
you
know, right.
You got to be, yeah. And you know, you want cilantro, but, you know, you start, what's interesting is the seeds of cilantro, you grind them up, they're cumin. So you got to figure out the best recipe. And I did, you know, I like fresh garlic, you know, red onions were my favorite.
And
you know, I like the jalapenos because they have a lot of flavor. They're not just hot.
Right.
They have flavor.
Right.
And that's what I liked. But a lot of people want hot. So, you know, okay, all right. So we'll put in some, hey, let's experiment. Let's put in some Thai peppers. That stuff is hot, you know. And pretty soon you can't taste it. It's so hot.
I agree with that. Yeah, I don't understand the super hot because it doesn't have flavor to me. It just tastes hot.
It burns, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And pretty soon you're sweating, you know. Go ahead.
Did you have taste testers? Did you have somebody else trying it and saying, okay, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? Or did you make all of the decisions like, this is the perfect sauce?
I made all my decisions, yeah. Yeah, because you can't trust it if people...
True,
you
know,
they got
true.
Their own preferences, yeah. So I know what I liked, you know, and that was fun. You know,
fun.
Yeah, I would grow in my backyard cilantro, you know, and I had an organic farmer. He lived a few miles out of town. And, you know, I wanted to grow my tomatoes because they're nice and thick.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you know, I sometimes, you know, put in bell peppers, you know, because I like how that is. They're a little sweeter, you know. Mm-hmm. Red bell peppers, even better, you know. But, I did it, you know, for a long time. And I thought, well, this is going to be it. And then soon enough, Paul Newman comes around and
ruins everything.
I mean, he got the name, he got the money, and he could say it goes to charity. How can I compete with that? You know?
Right.
Yeah. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest has been Phil Elkins talking about his experience as a salsa maker. I also want to mention that Phil has a series of books about various experiences in his life that are available on...
Well, we seem to have chopped that off. Phil's books are available on Amazon Kindle and... He has three or four of them dealing with his Vietnam experience coming home from the war and one just out serving as a single father with stacks of salsa in the living room. Here's a little more Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's Californication.
Sells Californication.
And here is tonight's Ecotopia recipe. Phal curry, P-H-A-A-L, is the world's hottest curry because it contains the world's spiciest chile, the Boot Jolakia, better known in these parts as the ghost pepper, which is three times hotter than the habanero. The dish is exceptionally spicy and not for the faint of heart. We're not going to give you the quantities here. Once you get the idea, you can do it yourself. Get together and finely chop in quantities to taste tomatoes. Throw in some water, garlic, ghost peppers. Wear gloves when you're handling the ghost peppers. Ginger, tomato puree, salt, chili powder, garam masala, cumin, coriander, fenugreek, and pepper. And then put it in a blender. Pulse several times to chop the ingredients and then blend it till it's liquefied. Transfer that mixture into a large bowl. Meanwhile, cube some lamb, as much as you want. Cover it with the spice mixture. Put that into the fridge for about an hour and let it marinate. Then, carefully pour the lamb and the marinade into a pot. Bring to a boil. Cook and stir until the sauce begins to thicken. That'll take about 5 minutes. Reduce the heat to really low. Simmer till the lamb is tender. That's about 20 minutes. Again, that's phal curry, the world's hottest curry. And it comes to you courtesy of KZFR. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We have an update tonight on the status of Valley's Edge, the enormous sprawl development east of Chico. Smart growth advocates and Save Our Hometown are opposed to despoiling the wetland and oak savanna land on which 2,777 housing units would be built. They have launched a signature-gathering effort for a referendum that would bring this project to a vote of the people. If you're interested in signing the petition or in gathering signatures yourself, please go to the office of the Butte Environmental Council. That's at 313 Walnut, Suite 140. According to our co-host, Susan Chudy, a volunteer for Smart Growth Advocates, a project this consequential should be approved by the citizens of Chico and not by City Council. So thank you for listening to Ecotopia this evening. Coming up at 6 o'clock tonight, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. And I've lost the name of her guest. I'm sorry. I apologize for that, Bobby. Followed at 6:30 by Radioactive with Ginger Nichols. Thanks very much for listening to Ecotopia.
By Butte College, where your future starts with three-week classes beginning January 3rd. And they are offered online at the Butte College main campus or Chico Center. Can't join this winter? Spring classes include cosmetology and barbering, at the main campus, Chico and Skyway Centers, and their new Glenn County Center in Orland. Promise scholarships are also available for first and full-time students. Details at butte.edu/start. And by the printed image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The printed image open Monday through Friday, 9 to 3, and by appointment. More information by calling 5.